Going to move to item seven, PCN LLC. Giordano.
Right now, to deal with, because they don't have a wireless board, and they don't have trained staff.
What time is it now? Till now. I think we're moving along. Good morning.
Okay, the matter before you today involves PCN LLC's request for the use and development of tidal wetlands and for the encroachment over state-owned bottom, including the dredging of 1,144 cubic yards of state-owned bottom, including a 30 linear foot temporary bulkhead for construction access associated with the construction and installation of an approximately 2,654 linear foot steel sheet pile wall with riprap scour protection along Curl's Neck Swamp, tributary to the James River, and extending from an existing earthen levee to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers dredge material management area at Curl's Neck Farm in Henrico County. This project will require both a tidal wetlands permit and a permit for the use of submerged bottom. And this project is also protested by two adjacent property owners. Now, this project site actually has an extensive history with the agency. And so to kind of break up my presentation, I'm going to briefly introduce the project site, discuss the proposed project, and then I'm going to go into the history of the site. And then I'll conclude with an elaboration of the current proposal, the response to our public interest review, and state agency commentaries, and finally our staff recommendations. So the project site is Curl's Neck Swamp, and it's located in a tidal fresh reach of the James River in Henrico County. It's adjacent to Curl's Neck Farm, which is actually an historic place and is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Upriver from the project site is Jones Neck, which is also owned by Curl's Neck Farm. And its downriver neighbor is Presque Isle National Wildlife Reserve, owned by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. This is a regional shot of the project area. Curl's Neck Swamp is here, Jones Neck is upriver, and Presque Isle National Wildlife Reserve is downriver. Curl's Neck Swamp itself encompasses about 1,000 acres of swampland. It's a mix of tidal forested and tidal emergent wetlands and non-tidal forested and non-tidal emergent wetlands. Curl's Creek runs within the main stem of the swamp, and you can see here there's a small area that kind of sticks out. That is the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers dredge material management area. The proposed project area encompasses a total of 11 acres and runs along the southeast corner of the shoreline. The project will extend from this existing levee, which you can see here in the photograph, and will run down to this existing dredge material management area. This is a zoomed-in shot to show you a little better the existing levee that that is out there. That was actually installed in 1968 and 1969 and is the subject of the history of this project site. The existing levee is comprised of an earthen berm that's 4,800 linear feet long. It's got a 30-foot base width that tapers to 15 feet at the top. The berm crosses across the mouth of Curl's Neck Swamp, and it spans 800 linear feet, with 300 of that considered to be on state bottom. The part of the berm that crosses across the mouth of the creek contains two 48-inch tidal flap gates with two pumps. These water control structures are to facilitate water management within Curl's Neck Swamp. And the reason why this berm was installed with the water control structures was to control Curl's Neck Swamp through the enhancement of waterfowl habitat. The way it has run historically is that the water every summer is drawn down within Curl Swamp, which exposes tidal flats. Historically, it's been seeded with millet, and the drawdown conditions also facilitate the growth of native vegetation. In the fall, the area is flooded again, and the flap gates are closed to keep the flooding within Curl Swamp. And then in the spring, beginning March 1st to July 7th, based on the historical sort of background with this project, the gates are open to allow access for anadromous fish spawning. As you may be able to see in these photographs here, or in this aerial photograph, there have been tidal inlets that have formed over the years since the installation of this levee. Therefore, the current project proposal is to cut off these tidal inlets with the installation of the 2,600 steel sheet pile wall that will extend from the existing levee down to this dredge material management area. They're also proposing to install riprap scour protection on the inside of the steel wall. And to compensate for the direct impacts associated with the wall and the riprap scour protection, the applicants are proposing wetland mitigation within this tidal ditch here. It's a half acre mitigation area. They're also proposing to leave some area in reserve in the event that the temporary impacts associated with construction do not revegetate after receding. The primary purpose of the existing project, or the current proposal, is to continue the primary purpose of the existing levee, which was to control water levels to optimize waterfowl habitat. And the second purpose of this project is to preserve and protect the beneficial habitat within Curl's Neck Swamp from sea level rise. So now I'm going to go through the history of this existing levee that was installed in 1968-1969. This photograph was taken in 1937. It's a historical shot of Curl's Neck Swamp prior to the installation of the berm. Like I said, in 1968 and 1969, the previous owner, Mr. Richard Watkins, the owner of Curl's Neck Farm and Dairy Incorporated, installed the berm across the mouth of Curl's Neck Creek. Of Curl's Creek. It existed uncontested until 1981 when there was a complaint lodged about the levee. This led to the Army Corps of Engineers investigating the matter and determined ultimately that it needed a permit, and so the applicant or the previous owner submitted a joint permit application for the retention of the levee and to control water levels. In the cover letter that was submitted with the JPA, Mr. Watkins stated that he believed he owned Curl's Creek through the issuance of a King's grant and that a BMRC permit was not required. At the time, staff believed, and we still do, that the state owns the bottom of the tidal Curl's Creek, and that it required our permit. Staff attempted to resolve this matter with the issuance of a permit in 1983, and we conducted an environmental review associated with the project. This ultimately led to questions about anadromous fish access into the swamp after it had been bermed, and this led to a study done by VIMS over the course of 2 days in May of 1982. The results of the study showed that river herring accessed the swamp through the existing tide gates, and they spawned successfully within the creek. However, one question that was not answered by the study that is still of concern today is what is the fate of the spawning adults and the juveniles within the creek after the gates closed for drawdown in the summer. This VIM study in 1982 ultimately led to proposed special conditions in the permit that would require the gates to remain open from March 1st to July 7th for anadromous fish access. This is a shot from 1974 that was taken after the installation of the berm. And this matter ultimately went before the commission on June 26th of 1984 to resolve the issue of a permit. There was no resolution on ownership, and Mr. Watkins did not want to accept our permit because we wanted to retain or wanted to include a special condition that would allow for public access. Ultimately, the commission decided to enter into a consent decree with the previous owner, and that would preserve the property owner's right to litigate ownership in the future should the need arise. The matter took over 4 years to finalize the language of the consent decree, and during that period, before it came back before the commission, a protest arose on behalf of Mr. John Wyatt. The matter eventually came back before the commission in 1989. It came back four different times in February, March, April, and in May. I'm not going to go through everything in detail. The minutes are included in the commission book. But at these meetings, Mr. Wyatt, with a petition of 54 protestants, objected to the project, speaking about concerns related to the environmental impacts and water quality impacts associated with the berm, fishery resources issue, and ultimately the issue of public access. The issue of anadromous fish rose again as far as being able to access the creek, and the commission requested that the applicant consider a second tide gate. Ultimately, the applicant came back and said that the cost was not justified for a second tide gate because the VIM study had shown that fish were successfully accessing Curl's Neck Swamp. In May 4th of 1989, the matter came back before the commission for a final time. What you see before you here are the two permit drawings that were submitted and which became part of an after-the-fact permit that the commission ultimately approved at their May 4th, 1989 hearing. Again, protestants spoke on the issue of public access. And on the matter of public access, Associated Member Hayes said, and I'm quoting from the minutes here, "The commission is in agreement that nothing that the commission would do to approve or disapprove the consent decree would impede any right citizens would have to use the creek or to challenge the owner's claim to the creek. The commission approved an after-the-fact permit for this berm, with a special condition that allowed the commission to reconsider the public access issue upon the occurrence of a full and complete public interest reevaluation, including one or more public hearings. During staff's review of the current proposal, we found that the after-the-fact permit that was approved by the commission in 1989 was never executed. According to the historical documentation, there were two letters sent to the applicant requesting signatures and to be notarized and sent back to our agency, and that we could not find any confirmation that that was actually done. So while the ownership really has not been an issue in this current proposal because the applicants willingly came forward to accept our permit, we are not certain if the consent decree that was agreed upon in 1989 is still valid for the new owners of Curl's Neck Swamp. And also, the consent decree was conditioned on Curl's, the original owner of Curl's Neck Swamp, accepting in the commission's permit. So this could possibly invalidate the consent decree since they never actually accepted our permit, according to our documentation. So this is an aerial photograph from taken in 1984, and the important thing to take away from here is this is after the berm was installed, but you can see the development of these tidal inlets along the southeastern shoreline. This is an aerial photograph from 2011 that shows that these tidal inlets have persisted, and in some instances they have gotten larger. And this is ultimately what has led to the current application requesting the installation of the wall. So now I'm going to go through a series of photographs that were taken at two different site visits, one in August of 2012 and one in December 19th of 2012. This site photograph shows one of the larger tidal inlets that have formed along the shoreline. This is a series showing all different inlets that have formed. A particular note on this slide is the existence of the sandbag structure here and a wall structure here. Through our various site visits, we determined that there are, in several of these tidal inlets, the placement of sandbags and or walls, and none of these have received permits from BMRC, so we consider them all to be unauthorized structures, and we feel ultimately that these need to be removed from state bottom and from tidal wetlands. We believe these are somewhat abandoned attempts to close off these tidal inlets over the years. These are pictures of the existing levee and water control structures. The top two panels show the outward-facing tidal flap gates, and this is the James River on the left in both photographs. The one on the right was taken at the August site visit, and you can see there's some exchange here with the swamp. You can see water actively rushing out. The photograph on the left was taken in December where the tide gates are closed during the flooding of the swamp as there's no active water movement in the tidal gates. The two photographs on the bottom are taken looking behind the levee. Curl's Neck Swamp is on the right-hand side. And both of these were actually taken at the December visit. This is standing looking back at Curl's Neck Swamp. The top left photograph is from the December visit, and the photograph on the bottom is from the August visit. These are pictures of the proposed mitigation area. You can see in the background here, this is where the tidal ditch is, where they're proposing to mitigate for the direct impacts of the wall and the riprap scour protection. And this tidal ditch ultimately leads to an old borrow pit site that's on the property. Now I'm going to run through some of the project drawings that are associated with this application. There are a lot of drawings. I didn't want to go through them all for the sake of brevity, so I've just selected a few that I thought were important that got across the main points of the project. This is an overview of the project area, and the important takeaway from here is they're proposing the dredging here in one of the tidal inlets, and this is to allow for barge access for construction of the wall. It's a minor amount of dredging to -3 feet of mean low water. This is the proposed staging area. So the barges will be staged here near the existing levee system. They need to install a 30-foot temporary bulkhead for loading and offloading. And this is the cross-section of that proposed temporary bulkhead that will create impacts to 300 square feet of non-vegetated wetland area. These are general impacts associated with wetlands, general wetland impacts associated with the temporary and permanent conditions. The top panel is showing the temporary impacts associated with construction. So we'll have approximately 15-foot mats that we placed on the inside of the wall. And in the wetlands, I'd like to point out that the wall will be driven to a depth of -15 feet below the substrate. The bottom panel is showing the permanent conditions of impact, and this shows the sheet pile wall with the 5-foot riprap scour protection. Now I'm going to work through the detailed plan views that you can see. This is beginning at the dredge material management area, and this is all crossing just over wetland areas. As you're moving north, northwest, you're coming across some of the tidal inlets. And I'd like to point out that the orange is the area for temporary impacts for construction, and the red are the permanent impacts associated with the scour protection. In the tidal inlets, the applicant is proposing to not only install the sheet pile wall, but also to install a riprap berm on either side of the steel sheet pile wall to add more support to the structure. Moving down, you can see the tidal inlets get a little larger, and finally we're ending at the existing berm. And I'd like to point out that they have proposed to put in a second tidal flap gate for the enhancement of fish access into the swamp. So now I'm going to go through two sort of specific cross-sections associated with the tidal inlets themselves. This is one of the smaller tidal inlets, and the proposed berm width on either side of the steel wall is going to be 11.5 feet across eight bottom. And again, I want to point out, in the tidal inlets, the steel sheet pile wall will be driven to a depth of 20 feet below the substrate. This bottom panel here is showing the proposed temporary construction access. What the applicant is proposing to do is they're going to put down a temporary riprap causeway in the tidal inlets while they're installing the wall, and then they're going to reuse that riprap scour, use that riprap in the scour protection to save costs. And this cross-section is associated with the smaller tidal inlet right next to the existing berm. The second cross-section is showing one of the larger tidal inlets. This actually is the inlet associated with the second tidal flap gate they're proposing. You can see the base width here of the riprap berm is going to be 21 feet, and the associated temporary impact is going to be larger at 31.1 feet. So this is the cross-section of the second tidal flap gate that they have proposed. The left panel is showing the tidal gate from the side, and the right panel is showing it from the front. And of note here is that the flap gate will be inverted minus 1.5 feet below mean low water. This is all we have. There were no operation protocols associated with the second flap gate, but it's assumed that it will be operated in a similar manner to the other existing flap gates. This is the proposed mitigation area for the direct impacts associated with the wall and the riprap scour protection. This is a tidal basin here that leads to through this tidal ditch to an old borrow pit site, and the mitigation will be half acre on the left side of this tidal ditch. This is the proposed drawing of it. The green is the emergent wetland compensation, and the light green is the tidal forested wetland compensation. And the dashed area is showing the area held in reserve in case the temporary impacts are not revegetated. And this is the cross-section they provided. So upon staff's request, the applicant's agent, Williamsburg Environmental Group, did analysis of the existing water conditions within Carlson Swamp. And this illustration here is showing what the current conditions of open water are within Curl's Neck Swamp. And according to their analysis, this will not vary much with the installation of the wall. This is the proposed conditions during drawdown. 80 to 94% of the water volume will be exported out of the Curl's Neck Swamp area, exposing 406 to 610 acres of swamp land. This includes forested wetlands, emergent wetlands, and submerged bottom. Of this total area, 210 acres are of submerged land. This scenario has implications for fishery resources, which I'll elaborate more on when I get to the BIMS comments of the project. Our public interest review revealed 5 letters of support. They came from the Honorable Walter Stosch, Senate of Virginia, Dr. Leonard Smock, VCU Rice, Director of VCU Rice Center, John Vitalkis, the Henrico County Manager, Mr. Thomas Brown, Craig Leshack of Ducks Unlimited, and we received another letter on Friday from the Director of DCR, Department of Conservation and Recreation, David Johnson. All of these letters discuss the importance of this project to protect tidal wetlands and to preserve this important habitat for waterfowl and wildlife. They commend the applicants for using private funding to fund such a large project with benefits to the natural environment. Our public interest review also revealed 2 letters of protest from nearby property owners. They came from Mr. George Little and Mr. William Rhodes. Both of the protestants object to the project because of lack of public access to state bottom within Curls Creek. They urge the commission to consider the precedent that it sets to approve the installation of a wall for across discuss the precedence that it would set with the commission to block off public access and that other property owners could do the same thing. And they request that public access be reestablished to this part of Curl's Neck Swamp. We received comments from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is an APO to the project, and they requested time of year restrictions on construction from late March to early June and early September to October. And this is to minimize water-based disturbance during migratory bird season. And they also request safety measures for boat operators, and this is because they have a lot of waterborne activities going on associated with the reserve, and so they requested something along the lines of a no-wake zone around the construction site. We received comments from the Department of Conservation and Recreation. They document the existence of the northern harrier in the project area, and this is listed as a Virginia species of concern. They did not, however, provide any specific recommendation with regard to this species. They document the project area's proximity to Turkey Island Creek Stream Conservation Unit, and they documented the existence of the endangered Atlantic sturgeon in the project area, and they recommended coordination with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as well as Virginia's Department of Game and Inland Fisheries concerning any possible effects on Atlantic sturgeon. They also document Curl's Neck Conservation Site in the project area, and they document the existence of sensitive joint vetch, which is an endangered plant. They recommend conducting a survey between August 15th to October 15th. And upon the receipt of survey results, the DCR said they can provide more specific recommendations on how to protect this resource. They also recommend coordinating with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service regarding sensitive joint vetch. We received comments from the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries. And their comments identify the benefits that this water management scheme and this proposed project have for waterfowl habitat and resident and migratory wildlife. They also, however, point out that Curls Creek and Swamp area is considered an anadromous, or is categorized as an anadromous fish use area. And they raise concerns about potential adverse impacts on anadromous fish. And they recommend maintaining connectivity with the James River during in-migration, spawning, and out-migration. They were unable to provide specific recommendations for the protection of anadromous fish because of the lack of design specifications and operation protocols for the existing and the proposed structures. They request that the applicant continue to coordinate with them for the implementation of a water management scheme. They, too, recommend coordinating with NOAA Marine Fisheries Service for any possible impacts on Atlantic sturgeon and coordinate with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on bald eagles, as the project area is in the James River bald eagle concentration area. Generally, they request working in coordination with the oversight agencies and institutes to facilitate research and monitoring of Curl's Neck Swamp, the mitigation site, and the associated environment. Finally, we received comments from BIMS. And their comments were long and technical, and I'll do my best to distill it down here. They raised several concerns with the potential impacts of this project on tidal wetlands and possibly, more importantly, fishery resources. With concern to tidal wetlands, they identify this area as a forested tidal hardwood swamp, which is itself a unique habitat and serves important functionings for nutrient cycling, floodplain attenuation, and presents itself as a sediment deposition area. They raise concerns that this project could fundamentally alter these shorelines and interrupt some of the natural processes and functions that these shoreline wetlands provide. They were unable to assess any impacts to wetlands behind the impoundment, because there were not enough details provided in the application to assess any possible effects. They do, however, anticipate that there will be secondary impacts to these wetlands behind the impoundment due to the altered hydrology during active water management. When the area is exposed, these wetlands will be exposed to temperature extremes and other stressors that they wouldn't be under natural conditions. NOAA Marine Fisheries Service and the Army Corps of Engineers also expressed the same concern in the comments that they submitted to our agency. Again, possibly most importantly are the impacts to fishery resources. And this is impacts on blueback herring, alewife, collectively known as river herring, and the American eel. These three species are currently being reviewed by NOAA Marine Fisheries Service for listing under the Endangered Species Act. So the potential impacts of this project on river herring stocks as well as American eel stocks really cannot be ignored. VIMS identified that the proposed water management plan could pose considerable threat to these stocks of fish. As you can see from this illustration, the drawdown conditions reduced the habitat by a significant amount by exporting 80-94% of the water area. This drawdown will overlap with river herring juvenile and larval stages utilizing Curl's Neck Swamp as a nursery. This could the water management plan could also disrupt American eel behavior because it will overlap with developmental life stages and migratory phases both in the spring and the fall. BIMS discusses that the existence of this wall will pose a migratory barrier. They discuss the wall as a physical barrier. They also discuss that water quality conditions around the swamp, since this will be an altered state, could also pose itself as a migratory barrier. And I'm quoting BIMS comments here, this is one of the most important factors in the decline of anadromous Allison runs. Under the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission Interstate Fishery Management Plans, states in these, we have the responsibility to protect stocks and improve habitat conditions for these stocks of fish. And the BIMS identifies that this project runs counter to the objectives of the ASMFC's Interstate Fishery Management Plans. NOAA Marine Fisheries Service also identifies that this project is contrary to ongoing efforts by NOAA Marine Fisheries Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and other federal and state agencies to protect, restore, and enhance anadromous fish, migration, spawning, rearing, production, and nursery habitat. So there are some serious implications of this project with regard to the depleted stocks of fishery, river herring, and American eel. Generally, BIMS views the renewed tidal connectivities of Curl's Neck Swamp as beneficial to wetland habitat and fishery resources. They acknowledge that the existing conditions are altered conditions, but do feel that the renewed connectivity is beneficial. They believe that there's more information that is required concerning this project, but generally they recommend that there should be long-term monitoring associated with this prior to the construction of the wall. If that's not feasible, they recommend a 3-year study after the construction of the wall, but before the implementation of any active water management. They also recommend the implementation of adaptive water management plan if this were to receive a permit, and that's to deal with changes in fishery behavior associated with changes in climate and sea level rise. So now I'm going to discuss staff's recommendation and summary of the project. PCN LLC's proposed extension of the levee system through the installation of a sheet pile wall is fundamentally a request to continue to manage Curl's Neck Swamp as been historically authorized for waterfowl management. On the surface, this request appears reasonable given the past commission's approval to manage the site for waterfowl habitat. In the over 20 years since the previous commission's approval, however, environmental conditions of the project site and the natural resources management goals and objectives within the James River have changed. Such conditions really cannot be ignored in light of the extreme uncertainty this project may have on living resources within the James River. The commission staff believes the commission should evaluate PCN's current proposal in the context of today's environmental and regulatory regimes and not rely solely on the historical precedents from the previous commission. With concern to ownership, the past commission's actions did not preclude public access, but it did establish a physical barrier to access. Staff feels that the commission can reconsider the public access issue based on the historical documentation that allowed reconsideration under a reevaluation and a new public interest review. And in light of the new protests received in this current review of a project, staff believes the commission can reconsider the matter. Regardless of the ownership of Curls Creek, this project will still require a permit from BMRC, and this is for the use and development of tidal wetlands, in addition to the encroachment over state bottom in the tidal inlet. The general common law concepts of erosion and accretion give erosion to the benefit of the state, and so the tidal inlets that have formed are jurisdictional for BMRC. Prior to any action on the current proposal, staff feels the commission must address the illegal status of the existing levee system. Staff feels that the commission has three options. First, the commission can authorize the execution of the original after-the-fact permit in the name of the current owners. Second, the commission could choose to issue a new permit that authorizes both the old levee system and the proposed additional wall. Or third, the commission can execute the old after-the-fact permit and issue a new permit for the proposed addition with the understanding that any new permit may modify the conditions in use of the original levee system and water control structures. Overall, staff feels that there are still questions left unanswered, particularly with regard to the impacts on fishery resources. The scope of the project and the possible adverse effects on the living resources within the James River warrant additional time to review and for the applicant to gather additional information and to work in coordination with the agencies to come to a better understanding of what the possible impacts are. Additional items, staff feels additional items to review should include, but of course are not limited to, the first, monitoring efforts and studies of diadromous fish use, spawning, and migratory patterns related to curls neck swamps. These efforts should be done in coordination with experts in the field and advisory agencies. The resulting data and information should be used to analyze the possible effects of the berm on river herring and American eel stock and propose mitigative efforts to reduce possible adverse impacts. Second, a clearly outlined and detailed timeline for the proposed opening and closing of the tidal gates and the associated water levels. This schedule should be approved by anadromous fish experts to ensure the swamp is open during the times of year that will not adversely impact migratory and spawning patterns of river herring and American eel. The schedule should be devised in coordination with advisory agencies to ensure consistency with ASMFC interfishery management plans, interstate fishery management plans, and current living resources regulatory goals and objectives. The schedule should also be flexible to accommodate new science and changing environmental conditions, if necessary. A tidal wetland survey quantifying the extent and existing conditions of the emergent and forested tidal wetlands along both the shoreline and within the impounded area. This data should be used to better quantify the effects of active water management on the wetlands within the bermed area, the potential recovery of the shoreline wetlands after construction, and the appropriate mitigation and compensation requirements. Four, an applied analysis on how the wall will prevent inundation of tidal wetlands at Curls Neck Swamp. This should include, among other items, a discussion on sedimentation patterns within the swamp and surrounding James River. And finally, and this relates back to a study that was done, or that was a report that was given by VIMS in the 80s when this project was, the original berm was being considered, a monitoring study of benthic habitat conditions and water quality within the bermed area to quantify the effects of the levee system on benthic environment and water quality. This data should be used to discuss the proposed impacts of impounding the area on benthic habitat and organisms and to modify the water management plan to reduce adverse impacts on water quality in the benthic environment. Finally, accordingly, after evaluating the merits of the project and after considering all of the factors contained in 28.2-1205A and 28.2-1302 of the Code of Virginia, staff recommends the Commission table their decision on permit issuance indefinitely to allow the applicant time to collect the necessary information, and the applicant must waive the right to a decision within 30 days pursuant to 28.2-1302-7C. If the applicant is unwilling to waive this right, then staff recommends denial of the application and recommends the applicant reapply after a year, submitting the requested additional information and coordinating with the advisory agencies to address the questions that were raised. I'll be happy to answer any questions that the commission may have, and I believe the applicant is here and represented as well.
Juliet, what page is the consent decree on in our package?
Number 11 is the item.
Yeah, it's item
11-4 has the issuance of the terms of the decree.
So it would be right before the minute.
Got it. Thank you. Questions for Ms. Giordano? Mr. Plumlee?
So over the 24-year period that there was no permit executed, were there any proceedings brought, show cause proceeding, to force the implementation of the court's order?
No, not according to the record.
So you have nothing in the record showing any attempt by the agency to do that?
No.
Is this new entity, do you know the nature of the transaction when they took over the ownership of the previous entity?
I do not know that.
Mr. Kugelman wants to speak to this issue.
Yeah, one thing I want to point out to the commission, and I appreciate what you're saying, but when we look at the terms of the consent decree, the court ordered this body to issue the permit.
And to be accepted.
Correct. And the plaintiff to accept it. So basically, legally, it was issued. I understand that there was a procedural abnormality administratively in that the former applicant did not execute the permit and turn it back into the commission. However, we have a court order basically saying that it is issued and they shall accept it. So it's counsel's view that it was issued based on the court order.
I don't think there's a dispute that it was issued. The question is whether it was signed and accepted by the plaintiff. That's what's been stated. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Plumlee?
I was just, the reason I wanted to understand how it was purchased, if there was a stock purchase, purchasing all responsibilities of the prior corporation, if that was done, then they would still be under the same binding order of the court, would be my understanding.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of the same mind that we have a lot to consider in this new application, and if we don't take care of this business that's been outstanding for some 24 years, we may miss our opportunity to get that taken care of in a less confrontational way. And I don't know if the current applicant has already agreed to accept and to sign, and whether that's sufficient under current view, the old 1989 permit.
My understanding is that they are willing to accept the old permit.
We'll hear from them shortly. Are there other questions, Ms. Giordano? Mr. Sessom?
I'm somewhat familiar with this property. I used to know, or I still know, the previous owners, and they did a fantastic job with maintaining habitat for waterfowl and resting areas. And I guess I have a question regarding the people that are protesting it regarding public access. Now, all of this area is on private property. Do you have a clip of the boundary of the property, of the swamp?
No, I do
the
not.
The property boundary?
I apologize, I don't have that.
What is their position regarding public access from what to what?
They believe public access should be restored from the James River to Curls Creek, which runs within Curls Neck Swamp. Curls Creek is a tidal creek that BMRC believes we own as state-owned bottom.
Is that one of the breaches?
No, that is the mainstream. I'll get back here.
Yeah, I'll take a look at that.
The best photograph of that would be the 19th. So this is Curls Neck. As it used to exist.
And they're saying they should maintain access through that creek to the swamp.
To the James River.
To the James River.
So from public bottom to public bottom.
Where would they access it?
And that's sort of the question, because the previous commission authorized the berm. Now, they believe what they did not negate the public's right to access the creek, but at the time, these tidal inlets had not formed, and so to access public bottom, they would have had to trespass on private property. So that's why they feel there should be some reestablishment of access to the creek. Now these tidal inlets have formed. Technically, they could access the creek through those tidal inlets since that is state bottom.
Okay.
Mr. Roberts?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question about the current connectivity to the river through those tidal creeks. This is basically a design question relative to the status quo. So how many tidal creeks are there currently connecting?
I don't want to quote an exact number, but multiple little inlets, branching inlets that are formed along the shoreline.
Okay, and how many new tidal gates would there be going into the wall?
Just one new one. So
one
there would be
one.
The
okay.
Two that exist at the mouth of the creek, and then one additional one that would be installed closer in, I believe, one of the larger inlets closer to the existing berm.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Juliet. We'll hear from the applicant.
Morning.
Yes, sir. All right. You're an attorney representing PCI?
My name is Dale Mullen. I'm with the law firm of Wire and Woods in Richmond. I specialize in environmental law, and I'm here today to represent the applicants while she's installing the PowerPoint, if I could introduce the folks who are here.
Sure.
First, I'd like to introduce Mr. Bill Goodwin. He is one of the co-owners of the property, also responsible for maintaining it just the way the wife and his family did. I also have Mr. Tommy Pruitt. second co-owner of that property. To answer your question specifically, yes, the rights and responsibilities would accrue to the former owner, do accrue to the present owner. Thank you very much. Honorable members of the commission, I have a presentation on behalf of the owners. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have. I'm going to start in reverse order, though, because I wanted to address specifically two things that came up at the end of staff presentation. The first, I believe counsel answered adequately. First, it's not an illegal permit. The permit that was executed by the court, by the Henrico Circuit Court, on actually, it's kind of strange, on May the 30th, of 1989 incorporated by reference the terms and conditions of the permit. The permit refers back to the court order. The court order ordered the plaintiff to accept the permit and the defendant to issue the permit. So it is in effect as a matter of law. At least that's our position, and I think one to which counsel agrees. Now, if that makes any difference to you at all, I will also tell you that Mr. Watkins has already agreed to execute the permit from May the 30th, 1989, if necessary. The reason no one fought it, the reason you never see a show cause, is because it is of legal effect to begin with. So to raise it now is, pardon the pun, a bit of a red herring. It's just not important to your decision today. Mr. Watkins can sign it, or if the board prefers, you could provide the very same application, and the current owners would execute it in the form in which it existed in 1989. So that issue should really come off the table because it's detrimental to the rest of the decision. Does that answer your question, Mr. Plumley?
Well, I think it addresses the question. I'm not sure it answers it. I think my preference is not to have any interpretation of what the court was asking to be done other than accept it in the formal way as set out. If there's a willing person to do that, I don't understand why that would hold up anyone.
We're willing to address it in any of those ways. The next
question, we'll sign a permit, ma'am. And I'm just trying to get through this. There's no question whether Tommy and I would sign a permit.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Is that right, Tom?
The second is access to private property. Currently, that property is private property. The entire issue from 1981 through 1989 centered on whether or not that was private or public property. The state determined in 1989 that they preferred not to negotiate or litigate further. The applicant decided they preferred not to negotiate or litigate further because what was being accomplished in 1989 was the preservation of important public resource, not public property, but an important public resource, which is a 900-acre wetland and marsh area that will otherwise,
and this is the first important point, the property, this is to orient you, this is north, this is south, this is east, back towards Richmond.
West
back towards Richmond. And you could orient me. And then east back towards the bay. You can tell because this small cut through was constructed in 1931 by the city of Richmond to provide deep draft access without having to go all the way around what were called the curls of the James, also because of the Curls family, but the curls of the James River. The city of Richmond came in 1931, and with the permission of the landowners, another interesting fact, this part is Chesterfield County, this part is Henrico County. It was only cut because of this little pass through here. If the board determines to reverse the course that has existed since 1968, it's important to recognize that this is just seeking to continue what has existed since 1968. If the board determines to do nothing, or prefers to make the applicant wait, what will happen over time is Curl's Neck will turn into exactly what has happened at Jones Island. And this is all open water.
The river reclaimed it when this particular portion of the levee breached, and this is all open water. If you go to Curl's Neck, you will find tens of thousands of nesting and migratory waterfowl, as well as deer, other amphibious species, and wetland species. If you go to Jones Island, if you like open water, and that's okay, but that's what happens to Curl's Neck if there is a reverse of course from what has happened from 1968 all the way through 1981 to 1989 and into the present day. This particular portion is the existing berm structure. This was closed in 1968. The tidal flap gates were constructed with the help of the government. They were designed with the help of the government, and it existed unchallenged until 1981, when an individual was found trespassing, to answer your question, upon the property of Curl's Neck Farm. They were asked to leave. And because of that, they filed a complaint. The Corps of Engineers came in, and nearly 10 years of litigation resulted in the consent order that you see in front of you in the package. This has been in existence since 1968. This particular hill is about 30 feet high. It's spoils from dredging that the Corps of Engineers places. They access that by driving on a one-mile road across the front of the southwesterly portion. They access that by driving on a road, and then they dump the dredge spoils. The only portion that is at issue today is this 2,600 linear feet section that will be composed of a 2-foot wall in the woods that you will not even be able to see from the James River, to preserve what has existed since 1968 and well before that. Otherwise, this is the alternative.
Where is that 2,600 feet start and stop?
Starts here, mm-hmm. Mr. Beck, mm-hmm. at the southeasterly portion of the existing berm, and it ends at the southeasterly portion of the dredge and fill. This portion right here marked in green. This is something else that makes this project unique. It is fair to say that in an ordinary course, the waters of the state accrue to the benefit of the state, and the lands accrue to the benefit of the landowner. That's what's different in this case. This land was granted, as you probably well know, under a crown grant from the 1600s. There's a case, a Virginia Supreme Court case, Commonwealth versus Morgan, that was litigated for nearly a decade, that changes that and says that if it was granted prior to the Declaration of Independence by the King of England, then the bottom of the river, too, belongs to the landowner. That's why the historical nature of this is different. And that's why, in 1989, the state decided we want this to exist as it has since 1968. The owners want this to exist as it has since 1968. Why are we fighting over who owns it? We already have a structure. We have for over three decades. Let's just leave it as it is because it is a private benefit for a public good. That's why it's historically significant. The existing levee system was installed between 1968 and 1969. The first challenge didn't come until 1981. The farm manager caught someone trespassing. I want to answer a question about the breaches. The question was, can you access the interior of the property using the surface water currently? The answer is, only if you have a chainsaw, and you'll notice from some of the photographs that staff showed, it has been chainsawed out. Someone has actually trespassed across using those existing finger inlets with a chainsaw and a boat, and with considerable effort, made it back about 30 or 40 feet. And the reason is, as the tide comes in, and continues to wash out the wetlands, continues to clear out the marsh, just like Jones Island, the trees are falling and covering up whatever existing tidal inlets exist. Yes, sir.
Why would somebody want to access it?
I don't know. I was there Friday. I walked it. I'm sorry, Thursday. I was there Thursday. I walked it. I think they probably wanted to access it either to poach or to fish. I can't tell. But they didn't get very far. It looked to me like, and I'm a novice, I'm no chainsaw expert, it looked like about 8 or 10 hours of chainsaw work to me. And I don't know if they gave up or what, Mr. Beck, but I don't know. I honestly don't know. Because when you get back there, it's marsh. It's inhabited by deer. It's inhabited by amphibious creatures. It's inhabited by wetlands, fauna, and flora. It's also inhabited by at least 6 bald eagles that have been spotted within the last 2 months. It's an active preserve for habitat. But the first challenge was 1981. The result was, after a year of negotiation, nearly a decade of litigation, finally some conditions that required title for flap gates, and this is another key point, to remain open from March 1st to July the 7th. That was the state's first attempt, based on extensive study, to set up terms and conditions for the landowner that were beneficial not only to the landowner, but also to the environment. March 1st to July the 7th. And that particular condition exists unchallenged to the present day. Some may say, well, we don't know, but there's certainly nothing new to supplant that March 1st through July the 7th is protective of the aquatic species of fish that are in danger, or alleged to be. May 30, 1989 was the consent order. That's tomorrow, by the way. This is a vision of landowners that dates all the way back to Mr. Richard Watkins. The vision is to maintain a public property for the public good. That has been the case since 1968, and that is the vision that Mr. Bill Goodwin, that is the vision that Mr. Tommy Pruitt would like to advance from here and for the rest of their lifetime. A private property for the public good since 1968. Its primary purpose, and this is stated in the application, is marsh preservation. It's motivated not by a profit motive. It's motivated by a desire to preserve the habitat. Ordinarily, you might see a case where individuals, and I also want to take this opportunity to point out where this is located. This is Route 5 back into Richmond or down to Williamsburg. And along Route 5, you'll see two white columns out by the road. Those two white columns, if you were to make a turn, take you south towards the river. You will then find 1,500 acres of farmland that has been reclaimed from what was at one time a quarry, has been reclaimed and is planted using exclusively no-till methods currently. Very difficult to make a profit using no-till. I haven't plugged into their business methods and practices, but they do that not because they're motivated by profit, but because they want to preserve this as open space and habitat for waterfowl. But it's really nice. It's one of a kind. I've heard that said before. It's unique in all of Virginia for one reason, because of where it sits and what it is. I'll give you another reason that's unique in all of Virginia in just a minute. But it's not motivated by a profit motive. It's motivated by a desire to preserve the habitat, and that motive was shared by the Commonwealth up to and including 1989. We would ask certainly that you not change course or direction today. It's a beneficial habitat for the bald eagle, for waterfowl, for fish, for deer, and for plants. The whole purpose is to prevent the loss of the marsh and the habitat. How do we do that? We prevent inundation and loss of the entire marsh. Again, if nothing is done, this will eventually be reclaimed by the James, washed downstream, and turned into open water. That habitat will disappear if no action is taken. The habitat will be preserved if the owner is allowed to put in that 2,600 linear feet sheet pile structure. The proposed sheet pile structure is designed to preserve and continue the primary purpose of the existing levees. Remember, these already exist and have for decades. These already exist. Their purpose is only served, and this is why it's infeasible. It is not feasible to ask private landowners to construct a very expensive sheet pile wall to preserve habitat, to also ask them, as staff did, to consider putting in structure to allow the ingress and egress of fish. They did. And then say, but once that's done, what we want you to do is to leave that tidal gate open for several years while we decide what you should be allowed to do with it. That is not feasible. It is feasible to study the effect on fish after construction, and we came with a plan today for that. But it's not feasible to ask private individuals on private property to install structures to preserve for the public good and then leave them open so that the purpose of that structure is not served. And you'll notice that staff, very wisely, includes measures of feasibility. It's just not feasible. They have to continue the primary purpose of the existing levee system in regulated waters within the Curl's Neck Swamp. It allows the preservation of beneficial habitat from permanent inundation. There are significant positive benefits. Who supports it? It was left off the list of five, but Virginia Department of Game and Inland Fisheries actually wrote that this particular project is, quote, highly beneficial to resident and migratory wildlife. I think that's a recommendation. I believe that's a support. There was a recommendation to add a tidal gate. That's been done. That tidal gate did not exist as a structure in that sheet pile wall because it actually adds fish access that did not exist in 1968. Think about that. In 1968, when this was built, there was no anadromous fish access from the James to the intertidal waters, and yet they thrived. They thrive to this day. It was suggested by Department of Game and Inland Fisheries and others that we should add a tidal flow flap gate. That was done. It was done at additional expense, or will be done if permitted. It was added to the plan. Henrico County, the host county, has offered strong support of this as a benefit to the local community. Ducks Unlimited preserves 13 million acres of wetland since 1937. 13 million acres of wetland. They want to add this as 900 additional acres and have written a letter of support as additional and a balanced approach to mitigating the loss of wetlands. I'd like to pause here and say, you don't have to pick fishes or wildlife. Here is a situation where the state, if it continues on the current course through the commission, can have exactly both. You can have a habitat that's beneficial to the fish and a habitat that's beneficial to humans and the wildlife. This is one of those rare win-win situations. And I would add, at zero cost to the taxpayers. None. Zero cost to the taxpayers. Senator Walter Stosch has written a letter of support, I suspect in part because of his work on the Finance Committee, because no public money has been asked for to help provide preservation for this marsh area. He observes it is significant positive benefits for the citizens of the Commonwealth. These are unrefuted. These are things upon which we can all agree. This is a good project. Dr. Lynn Smock with VCU's Rice Center for Environmental Life Sciences has written, it has a, and I like this, if I had a theme, it would be this, high environmental value, low impact, that will be offset. High benefit, low impact. Extensive study has been done since 1989. This property has been studied since 1981 at least. The structures have been in place since 1968. All that is being done is simply to preserve the beneficial balance and the status quo that has been in existence for four decades plus. There is clear and convincing evidence from 1981 through 1989 to the present day of adequate access for fish, adequate access that will be enhanced through the addition of a tidal flat to the structure that is proposed. There's been extensive option analysis to minimize impacts. I will tell you the first plan was to construct an earthen berm. This is the existing berm. Now, this is kind of this picture, but turned into a drawing. The existing berm was simply to extend that using another earthen berm that joined to the spoils, the dredge pile. A recommendation was made that the footprint could be nearly eliminated by changing it to a sheet pile structure. The owners voluntarily chose to do that before coming here today. Staff has that in their report. The total net effect of that is preserving 900 acres of wetland with 0.24 acres of permanent impact. 0.24 acres of permanent impact that will be mitigated on site and is already part of the plan. That mitigation area will occur
here, right on site. I want to take this opportunity while we're in this area of the project. This is the proposed sheet pile wall, existing berm, mile-long road, and dredge pile. What's this? Anyone who's ever been on the James River in the summertime recognizes this as what is known as the harbor. People believe that the harbor is a public beach. There's a little beach. You can even see it here. This is an old photograph. These were placed here long ago. These are barges that were since removed for safety. People believe that this is a public beach. If you went there today, you would find people suntanning, eating lunch, fishing, swimming. If not, this is Curl's Neck. The idea that there is no public access at Curl's Neck is quickly put to rest by anyone who puts in a boat in Richmond and takes it down just beneath to the Curl and goes to the harbor. There is public access. The prior owner, Mr. Watkins, the present owners, Mr. Goodwin, Mr. Pruitt, have done nothing to prevent the public from using this. Minimal permanent footprint, 0.24 acres. It's a low-profile wall. It's only 1 to 2 feet high. It's in a forested area that's not even visible from the James River. This is a common-sense project. If this were the first time that such a project had ever been attempted, I would say it would require some really hard looks. But this is done all the time. One example, Ducking Stool Point along the James River in Charles City County. That was designed to protect 500 acres of wetlands from tidal effect. That was federally grant funded. This is private funds. Hog Island Wildlife Management, an area along the James River in Surry County, Virginia, almost 4,000 acres for the entire wildlife management area. It's managed by DGIF, has multiple points of perimeter control in the form of berms designed to control water levels, primarily for waterfowl habitat. Some of those areas contained were once tidal wetlands, also a project very much like this one. Difference? It's managed by the state. It's paid for by the taxpayer. The Blackwater National Wildlife Reserve, managed waterfowl habitat. It's on the eastern shore of Maryland. It's operated by the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. They have preserved, and look at this cost benefit. They have acted to preserve, using taxpayer dollars, 12 acres of managed wetlands with a 2-mile-long levee. We seek to manage 900 acres of marsh using 2,600 linear feet with 0.24, less than a quarter of an acre, of permanent impact. These are done regularly because it is widely accepted that wetlands, marshes, are worth preserving. That one has been in existence since the 1980s, with a recent project completed in 2010 to stabilize the levee. The applicant has been responsive in addressing the concerns. They changed a earthen berm to a sheet pile structure. There's already an agreement, and they're prepared to execute another agreement today that says we will leave those tidal gates open no later than March 1st and ensure they remain open until at least July 7 each year. How do we know it works? That's what's been done since 1989. And until today, there's been no effort to change it. No trips back to court. The consent decree says that if the parties wish to change it or alter it, they can come back to court, but no attempt to change it. It works. This is the firm date that is sought, March 1st to July 7th. An expert has been retained from VCU, Dr. Greg Garman. Dr. Greg Garman has agreed to and has written. Staff has been provided with this. Now, recall, we didn't receive the staff report until yesterday morning. But Greg Garman has prepared a report for management pre-construction, for study pre-construction, and for study post-construction. Now, that post-construction study is also post-construction and post-water management. The owner simply cannot install this very expensive structure along with the gates that were requested and just then leave those gates open. That's not currently what's being done now. So that cannot happen. But this is a doctor from VCU who works in marine science who has been retained and is going to be working on the pre- and the post-construction monitoring plan. It isn't even currently done.
At any point between 1989 and the present day, anyone could have come in and studied the fish. The only people who have made any effort to do that at all currently are the owners, and at their own expense. And that's important. Additionally, discussions were held with the VCU Rice Center for Environmental Life Science as recently as this morning. Dr. Lynn Smock has said that they are very interested in studying the effect on the wildlife post-construction along with the owners at Curl's Neck. What's in it for VCU? VCU already uses that property for their classes for the environmental life sciences. There's already a strong connection. They know Curl's Neck Dairy, and everyone knows that this is low environmental impact, high environmental return. The applicant changed the berm from a berm to a low sheet pile structure to minimize the footprint, agreed to put in additional tidal gates. That grants even greater access than before. They've agreed to monitoring and have clearly outlined and detailed a timeline for opening and closing the tidal gates. Mitigation has already been addressed. Public access is already granted. And a management plan is already in place to protect the ecological communities and the wildlife habitat. It reduces. We're not eliminating the tidal cycle. The owners don't seek to eliminate the tidal cycle. They just want to manage the tidal cycle so it's beneficial for habitat and also beneficial for the fish species. It promotes emergent vegetation growth, and it helps the forested systems resist higher water levels. So what's the plan? What we'd like to ask the commission to consider today is a plan that allows the issuance of a new permit that authorizes the former levee system and the proposed sheet pile wall. It would specify the March 1 through July 7 tidal gate that the state and the former owner fought about for nearly a decade, and it would provide for a 3-year monitoring and assessment program to address the river herring and eel utilization at Curl's Neck and water management structures after construction and during water management. This is important. After construction and during water management. It doesn't do any good to install this expensive system and then just allow more inundation than what occurs currently. Dr. Greg Garman has been retained privately. The VCU Rice Center has expressed interest in the plan from the public aspect. And I'm available to answer any questions or comments you may have. Additionally, Mr. Tommy Pruitt is available to speak if you have specific questions for the owner, would like to ask the owner.
Okay. Questions? Mr. Plumley.
What year was that aerial taken?
What was the question?
What year the aerial was taken? Okay. So it's a fairly recent photograph of the condition, or relatively recent. I wanted to take you through, because there's been a lot of information presented. There was a lot of information previously presented as well. We need to kind of consider all of it. The staff has presented, and I think you might have before you, I'm not sure if you do, the staff recommendations for additional studies, additional work. And I take it from your presentation, though you didn't take us down the request specifically, that your position is this information is generally not needed at this point to go forward with our consideration. Is that your position?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And that's with regards to all of the requested additional information from staff?
Not necessarily. If you had a specific, what I tried to do is pick the ones that...
I mean, I can go down the list with you, but if you want to do that, I don't know if you have it right there.
I do, actually. The monitoring efforts and studies, if this is under the summaries and recommendations, but
right.
The ones that I had looked at were at the end of the issues.
Yes.
I know that yours, mine didn't have numbers on the page.
Okay.
I'll say where it says issues continued. They offer the following as recommendations should this project receive a BLRC permit. A permit condition requiring long-term monitoring and assessment, addressing river herring and eel utilization and contribution to the James River system. We have that plan. That's Dr. Greg Garman from VCU. Now, one detail, pre-construction monitoring is preferred, but if that is not feasible, the 3-year monitoring period after construction but prior to implementation of water management
I'm not 100% sure what that means, but it sounds to me like they would like the owner to go ahead and build it, construct it, put in the flap gates that we've asked for, and then just leave the flap gates open. I think that couldn't be what they mean, but I don't want anyone to misunderstand that that's not feasible. That's not what the ecosystem currently has now. So I do feel like we have addressed that one, Mr. Plumlee. With regards to the footprint, we addressed that early on. The tidal gate, we addressed that early on. And I believe that the public access issues the general public may prefer to walk across the farm property and go fish on a farm pond than the farm. That's simply not realistic. There is public access.
Mr. Mullen, if you could look at the last page of the staff recommendation.
Yes, sir.
You'll see paragraphs number 2 through 5.
Yes.
And those are, I guess, some additional items that the staff is looking for. If you flip back to the previous page, you just addressed number 1.
Yes.
Pretty clearly. Any thoughts on 2 through 5?
Sure. And this may also speak to your point, Mr. Plumlee. A clearly outlined and detailed timeline. We've even got the dates year by year. Oh. I believe that that's addressed under our plan number 2. A clearly outlined and detailed timeline for the proposed opening and closing of the tidal gates and associated water levels.
And that would be March 1 to July 7.
Yes, sir. March 1 to July 7 is what's currently being done and what was incorporated in the 1989 consent order. A tidal wetlands survey quantifying the extent and existing conditions of the emergent and forested tidal wetlands along with shoreline and within the impounded area. I will tell you that in your binder, you have substantial information concerning the wetlands. It's been delineated. It's been logged. It's been reduced to writing on several occasions. I believe that number 3 has been addressed. If there's more that's needed, I don't know what that would be. We talked about this a great deal, and I would just be guessing because, as I said, we only received this yesterday morning at about 6:30 in the morning. So, and applied. So I think that that has been addressed by the studies that were done by the engineers from the Williamsburg Environmental Group, 3 of whom are here today. I believe 3 has been addressed. I think 4, an applied analysis of how the wall will prevent inundation of tidal wetlands at Curl's Neck Swamp, including a discussion on sedimentation patterns within the swamp and surrounding James River. I'm a little unclear on what exactly a study like that would even encompass. I know for certain that as Jones Island continues to wash away, it provides sediment. I know for certain that the Corps of Engineers have a structure constructed to dredge the James so that you can still have deep ground ships up to deep water terminal in Richmond. What else Curl's Neck is required to study and how far out of the James is required to go? Say sedimentation and erosion control are good. I do not know. I mean, that's really kind of the essence of the project, is to prevent the loss of land to the river. And then monitoring the benthic habitat conditions, I don't know that we have such a study, but I also don't know that after 40 years that such a study is necessary. We know for sure that the habitat is healthy. And so all they're seeking to do is to preserve what has existed since 1968.
Yes. Mr. Fox.
You said that the steel wall will only be 1 to 2 feet above the ground level?
Yes, sir.
At that low protrusion, how is it going to hold the water in or the water out?
There will still be tidal intrusion. It isn't the goal to manage all of the tidal intrusion, but just that which is causing loss of the habitat. So it is. It's a very low wall. In fact, the tidal gates, when either open or closed, don't by themselves control all of the inundation in or also the tidal flow out. They're just not big enough to accommodate that. So,
but you have to control it enough so that the higher parts of the low grounds are out of the water so they can be planted.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
And 1 to 2 feet will do that?
Do you perhaps this would be a question better addressed to the engineers or to the let the engineers talk. And I don't think that they've been sworn.
Made it.
Absolutely, Williamsburg Environmental Group.
You swear the testimony you give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, self to God.
I do.
Thank you.
Mr. Fox, would you mind repeating your question?
I've forgotten what it was now. But the wall is only 1 to 2 feet above the ground level.
Correct.
And how will that be high enough to keep the areas that you intend to plant from being inundated?
The control that we're seeking is between that 1 to 2 foot upper elevation and the lower elevation at the bottom of the gut. It is that area of the water column that is causing the flooding within the swamp. And to control that will allow Mr. Pruitt and Mr. Goodwin to dewater for a portion of the year to allow that emergent vegetation to grow. So it is only that control that we're looking for. We're not building a levee like you might have in New Orleans that's controlling storm surge. I mean, this area will flood. We predict it will flood. We've designed that into the structure itself for erosion control on the order of 2 to 3 times a year. So it's right now you get water up on top of the existing berm on occasion, that earthen berm. So low-profile structure.
Mr. Plumley.
We have the engineer here. Is there... With the construction of this wall, do you predict that there's going to be any other inlet development?
We've done
at other locations around the wetland.
If I can just briefly.
Is this an area also? Do you have the date of that aerial?
It's right here in the bottom corner.
I can't read it, but that's
like 2012.
Looks like a date. Okay.
We've looked at survey data across the existing berm for its full extent. Across the existing berm for its full extent. We've surveyed within the marsh itself, the forested wetland, and then we've also conducted a survey along the existing road. That is serving as a, it was built on, I believe, a natural levee, but also serves to help protect this backside of the property. This is a drivable road here. I mean, it's much shorter, up on this area, much higher elevation. So I believe that the correction between here and here will help contain the water. The core would likely do road improvements here over time, just provide access to the
direct
material management area.
Mr. Beck, did you have a question earlier?
It's a simple question. One of your sponsors is Ducks Unlimited. Is there duck hunting on this property?
Yes, sir.
There is?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Yes, sir. Mr. Sessoms.
This is basically an impoundment, right, where you can... You're going to control the water level so you can grow food for the waterfowl and then flood it so they can have access to eat it. And it's a resting area and a feeding area, basically, right?
That's how I look at it. It may not be the most scientific way, but that's how I see it.
Well, I can certainly say from, again, my experience here is that it serves. And these type of facilities are built all up and down the Eastern Flyway. Ducks Unlimited, Fish and Wildlife encourage this type of development.
Very rare that you see a project that you can preserve 900 acres
mm-hmm.
with less than a quarter of an acre and all at private expense. It's a rare project.
I even believe that there's federal and state, well, at least in North Carolina, I think state money to develop this type of product here.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, you said as you went through the presentation at one point that anadromous fish were thriving. I'm just curious if you can explain that or put it in context relative to the site.
I wish I had the picture back up that showed the exit structure, the 48-inch. Yeah, the 48-inch pipes. The other fish, one of the most popular places to fish, is back up against that structure, because when the smaller fish get forced out, and this is a fisherman's view, not an engineer or a biologist's view, okay? But from a fisherman's point of view, when smaller fish come out, the larger fish wait by that structure, and that's where some of the larger fish are caught in that area. I can tell you that Mr. Pruitt and his son were fishing just that area Saturday and pulled out a really nice bass. He showed it to me on his cell phone. We were comparing fishes. I fished a different area on Saturday. He got a much nicer set of fish than I did. But I know for certain that the fish are thriving in that area by the presence of the fishermen.
Mr. Mullen, you've agreed, or your plan agrees to a three-year monitoring and assessment of the of what the fish are doing in that area. And I guess my question is, I mean, nobody can predict what that monitoring is going to show. But if it suggested some changes were needed in the water management plan, can you speak to what would happen then?
Well, and that's a very good question, Commissioner. I'm hesitant to ask you to write a permit that would require the owners to open those gates at times that, based on the whim or idea of some scientists, because we all know that the experts are going to disagree. Whose opinion should we use? Well, certainly the landowner and the person paying for the structure should have some control over how that structure is used. So I'm hesitant to write a permit condition, and I hope you would be too, that would allow some future expert to come in and say, I think the gate should be left open all the time. So that's what you have to do. I don't know what the study will show. The landowners don't know what the study will show. I will tell you that the landowners, Mr. Bill Goodwin, Mr. Tommy Pruitt, are committed to the environment. They're committed to the waterfowl, to the wildlife, and to the fish species. And if it turned out that, I know the one core idea was to leave it open until the Corps of Engineers, that is, until July the 15th. That probably poses no problem. July 23rd, probably no problem. If somebody were to say, you need to leave it open until November 1st of every year, it would be an enormous problem. And it would really obviate the need for the legal fees, the engineering, the structure, the gates. If we're just going to leave it open and let it go to what Jones Island is, then that decision needs to be made as a policy. But that's a really good question, and I puzzled how to address it coming here today, except to say that 3 years of study will allow this commission, because you know we'll be back, will allow this commission and the state of Virginia to know more than they know now, and it will be done, again, at the private individual's expense. I don't know how much expense is reasonable for private individuals to undertake, but it will all be done, and it doesn't currently exist. No one thought to ask for it until yesterday morning at 6:30. We had anticipated it coming here. So it will be more than the state has now, would be my answer. But to say that we would open or close, I can't say that.
Mr. Fox?
I guess my question is, if we don't know what the study will show, but if we, the board, the commission, is prohibited from making changes in the contract based on the results of the study, if we're prohibited in doing that, then what's the purpose of the study?
I do not disagree, Mr. Fox.
Well, that goes back to the original questions about what would be agreed to in terms of study in advance of the project to provide us with the insight prior to a permit. You know, if you're coming for a permit, I believe you're subjecting yourself to our jurisdiction and to the terms and conditions we would find reasonable in the construction of the project. That was one of the things I'd written down. If you don't want to perform the studies, would you agree to come back at the end of the study period and be subject to decisions that would be resulting from those studies, you know, whether there was impact or not? I'm not sure there's going to be a study that comes back and says leave it open or change what's been done over the last 30 years or 25 years. I have no idea. I don't think anyone does, but it's difficult for us to sit here and allow the construction in a way without the information that the agencies are saying they need, which appears to be a reasonable request.
And it's an interesting point you bring up. My fear is a disagreement between the experts that can't be resolved. Different people can read the same data and see different things. I'll just say that no study has been done from 1968 to the present time that establishes a baseline. So one benefit to the Commonwealth is there would be a baseline of information. There would be a baseline of data at the expense of the landowner. One doesn't exist. So if my preference would be to see number three come out entirely, but I also understand how that might be displeasing to the commission.
Mr. Goodwin wants to speak, but I will note he has not been sworn in.
Can you come up to the mic? Let me swear you in. You swear to tell the truth, whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
Yes, sir. I think your question is right. You'd have to solve that problem, and I think you should come up with some mechanism to evaluate the study, for us to evaluate it, for staff to evaluate it, but I think you're exactly right.
So could
that's your only hang up. I don't know what y'all are thinking, but if that is your hang up, and if I was sitting in your shoes, I would try to get some mechanism to solve what you're asking for.
Could it be something as simple as a permit condition that gets you back here in 3 years so that we can all look at the monitoring results together and decide what if anything needs to change? Thank you. Mr. Robbins.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is the most critical component of the project from a fisheries perspective because, we've talked about it potentially being a win-win. I mean, clearly it's a win for waterfowl management and for waterfowl habitat. That's not in debate. The fisheries side of this is more of an open question. And if the water management plan adequately reflects the interactions with the Alicene species, then it could be a win-win. But those details are as yet unknown. And so I think, from a permitting standpoint, we have to consider that and recognize that at some point we'll have the results of studies. Now, I don't know that those studies will be so much in debate. I mean, I think what will be in debate is a policy decision in the end, because ultimately if you have early life stage river herring that are present in September or October, then what do you do, right? Do you make that the top priority in your management? Or, at the end of the day, I mean, it seems like we're trying to strike some balance between the management of this from a waterfowl standpoint, but also considering the impact on marine resources in the area. And that's where the potential impacts are. It could be significant for these anadromous fish that are coming in. Because keep in mind, I mean, the commission has already imposed a moratorium on the harvest of river herring. So in response to what the ASMFC has told us, we've told recreational fishermen they can't even keep a 5-gallon bucket of river herring. I mean, they can't possess any. And similarly, in the offshore fisheries, we've had to go to great lengths now to manage and impose catch caps on the offshore fleet on river herring. So it is a big deal from a fishery standpoint. But I think from a permitting standpoint, we'd want to make sure that we could review it periodically, as the commissioner pointed out, perhaps have a period of review where that water management program is reevaluated, because that's going to be the most critical piece in this, I think, in terms of how the property is operated and how these floodgates are maintained and when they're open, when they're not open. I mean, obviously, it's a spectacular project from a waterfowl management standpoint. It's been incredibly successful. But habitat modification is probably the single greatest problem for the Alicene species and has been throughout the past recent history in this region. So it's become very sensitive because it's a candidate species right now for an ESA listing. That decision is pending. We'll probably have it very soon. But regardless of that, we have to make sure that whatever protections are in place take into consideration those impacts on marine resources.
And certainly, you put your finger on the crux of the problem, Mr. Robbins. It's a matter of balance, and it's finding how to strike that balance. I will say a completely unbalanced decision would be one where the owners come back in 3 years, and the commission says, take all the clap gates on all the levees and the wall, 10 open. They're open all the time. Well, then the landowner just invested substantial private funding to do something that only worked for 3 years. And if that happens, I would say respectfully.
Right. Right. Would you make a motion?
Yeah.
This is also not, this is not balanced. If it turns into Jones Island, that's a loss of all of that species habitat as well. And so there probably is, but my fear is what happens at that 3 year period. And that's really a question for the landowner. That's a cost benefit analysis. Is it still in our feasibility? Is it still within our reach to preserve this while also risking all of this capital for something that someone could come back 3 years later and undo?
They need to be willing to do that.
Yeah, they do.
Okay.
You need to discuss some of this. Yeah.
We still have to hear from the protestants on this, and then you'll get a rebuttal time. Do what? There's no clock.
Okay, thank you very much.
There's no clock. Unless there are other questions for the applicant, we're going to hear.
You take a break.
You need to take a break?
Yeah.
We're going to recess for 10 minutes, and then we'll come back and hear from the protestants, and then rebuttal.
Okay.